one more for the thawab of all of the marhumeen from our families, our community, and our friends, the ulama and the shuhada. Surat al-Mubarakatul Fatiha. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين الحمد لله الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء وسيد المرسلين وشفيع المذنبين سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد والصلاة والسلام على أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما مولانا وسيدي صاحب الأسر والزمان روحي وأرواح العالمين له الفداء وأجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف ولعنة دائمة على أعدائهم ومنكر فضائلهم من الآن إلى قيام يوم الدين أما بعد رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي. For the hastening of the advent of our 12th Imam Imam Al-Hujjat and a world of peace and justice and equality, one loud salawat upon Muhammad and the family of Muhammad, please. My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Tonight we want to continue in the discussion that we began, I believe it was 2 weeks ago, on the theme of being the secrets of the salat. And for those who remember 2 weeks ago what happened, which is probably very few of us, because I don't remember what we talked about 2 weeks ago, we discussed about the intention, the niyat. And one of the reasons why I chose to look at the niyat, and not just the ahkam, the rulings from the marja or the maraja that we follow, but also what we refer to as the secrets, meaning not just the wisdom or the philosophy, but the inner understanding of the intention. And we mentioned in our last discussion, just as a recap for all of us, that the intention is the most important action that we as a believer can do for any action that we do. As we had mentioned, that beautiful tradition from Rasulullah, which all Muslims quote in their books, where Rasulullah says, إِنَّمَا الْأَعْمَالُ بِالنِّيَاتِ, that indeed your actions are based, or are the crux of your actions are the intention, why you're doing something. And the Prophet talked about how when a person does something for the sake of Allah, or they make the intention to do something for the sake of Allah, even if they don't attain that, if they don't reach to that goal, they still get the reward of intending to do something for the pleasure of Allah. And we know that the intention is the key to every action in Islam, from praying to fasting to Hajj to charity, to every little thing that we can think about, everything goes back to the intention of why we are doing something. Before I continue on with that part of our discussion, I want to offer one clarification from what I talked about last week in the ahkam portion, and also one correction in one of the rulings that I mentioned. So one of the things that I mentioned last week was about in the Jamaat prayer, in the congregational prayers, I talked about Mumayyiz children, and I think maybe hopefully remember that. And so I wanted to just clarify what I mentioned and give you the actual wording from the newest edition of the Risala of Ayatollah Sistani, which was published just a few months ago. I mentioned, as Ayatollah Sistani mentions in his book of Islamic rules, that one of the groups of people that can be in the front row, that can serve as a connector between either the men or the women, is a child who may not be baligh yet, so that boy or girl has not yet reached the age of maturity that Islam has defined, but that they are mumayyiz. And mumayyiz, as Sayyid Sistani defines in his risala, is a child who can discern good from bad, right from wrong. And also, obviously, that they know how to pray, so they have the wudu, they have the tahara, they know the method of prayer. And I mentioned a few different ages from 6 to 8 to 9 to 12. I want to make one clarification that just because a child is 8, a girl, for example, who's 7 or 8, or a boy who's 10 or 11, and might be baligh yet, That doesn't mean that it's a carte blanche, that now they have general access to the front line to join and to make a connection. But rather, if the parents feel that the children who are coming to the Jamaat prayers, and you feel that your son or daughter is at that level of mumayyiz, and they perform the wudu, they know how to pray, they're not going to disrupt the congregational prayer by being in the front line, then please, by all means, allow them to be in that line. But if you as parents feel that, or grandparents, if you feel that your children aren't yet ready, they're at that age, but they maybe aren't ready to be in that front line, because we know that that connection is important, because if their prayers become null and void, then people who are around them need to know what they have to do, changing their intention and doing their prayers on their own. So let me just show you on the screen the recent wording from the Risala of Ayatollah Sistani, what he mentions. So he says that if the link person in the congregation is a mumayyiz child, meaning a child who is able to discern between right and wrong, then in the event that the people in the congregation do not know if his prayer is invalid, they can join with him. And the same applies if the link person is not an Ithna-Ashiri Shia, so they're from the Ahlu Sunnah, or they're from another group. In the event that their prayer is valid according to their religious denomination, according to their madhab. So in a nutshell, if a child is mumayyiz, they're in the front line, and you don't, and there's nothing for you to tell that their prayers are void, they can remain there and they can be that connection. Again, but I put the onus on the parents or those who are bringing the children for you to ensure that you know that that child fits that criteria and that they should be there. If you have a doubt, let them be in the second line. Inshallah, they can still pray the Jamaat and get the reward for it. And also, as Ayatollah Sistani clearly mentions, and this is a new ruling in the sense that this wasn't in the previous version of his Risala, he clearly mentions that a non-Shia Ithna Ashari, as long as they're praying according to their madhab, if they're praying according to their rulings of fiqh, they can be also a connector in our Jamaat, and there is no problem with that. So hopefully that clears and clarifies that point. The second thing which I want to correct and further just explain for a minute or two is what I mentioned when I said that when you want to join the prayers that you have to make two takbirs. The one is takbiratul ihram I mentioned, and the second is the takbir to go into the ruku. So just a correction on that is that that second takbir is not wajib. It's not an obligation to make that takbir. But what is wajib is to ensure that you are standing motionless for even a second or a split second before you go into ruku. So there's a principle in the salat where you have to stand motionless when you do the takbir before you go into the next action. And so Ayatollah Sistani says that it is an obligation to stand for a short while, both before and after saying the takbiratul ihram, in order to be certain that the takbir had been said while you were standing motionless. So just to clarify, the second takbir is not mandatory, but just for you to make sure that you have said your first takbir, your body is still, and then you go into that next position, that is basically what we have to ensure that we have within that time if we're going to join the Jamaat prayers, and we haven't, for example, started right at the beginning. So the Jamaat is in ruku and we want to join just to make sure that we follow that particular ruling. Hopefully that's clear, that hopefully clears any confusion that I may have come up in our discussion last week. One salawat upon Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Coming back to our discussion for tonight about the intention, about the niyat. And again, last week we looked at some of the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, of the importance of forming that intention. And tonight I want to look at a few of the other rulings and also a hadith that talks about the intention and the importance of intention and how it relates to us in the next world, in the world to come. Some issues about the intention that Ayatollah Sistani mentions. And again, this is a refresher, hopefully, for us. Maybe we'll learn something new if we haven't seen these rulings before. But one of the things that people ask sometimes is that, for example, we gather Laylatul Qadr, and somebody will say, well, what is my intention? What do I have to say? And what we have to appreciate is that the niyat, the intention, we don't have to say it verbally. So for example, I don't have to say I'm praying Maghrib 3 rakat behind the imam of this jamaat, qurbatan lillahi ta'ala. There's nothing wrong in doing that though. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying don't do it, but to formulate the intention in my head or verbally declare it out loud is not required in the religion. But if that helps you focus and it helps you be in that presence of mind and understanding what you're about to perform, then by all means, we can verbally declare the intention, we can spell it out in our head with all of the particulars, there's no problem with that. But just sometimes maybe we get the namaz late and we're running in from the entrance to get to the jamaat namaz, and we pause for a few seconds to think about our niyat, and maybe we miss the connection, so we don't have to do that. So even us coming to the center, let's say we left home at 5:30, we got here at 5:45, and we knew when we left home that we were coming for jamaat namaz, that right there was our intention, leaving home, coming to the center, walking in, that was our intention, was we were here to pray. So if we don't do the niyat and you forget about it, don't think that your prayers are void. There's no problem as long as you knew what you were here for and you know what you were about to perform, then that will be sufficient in terms of the intention with Allah. Obviously, the intention is important, and everything that we do as Muslims has to be for the sake of Allah, to earn proximity to Allah. But the scholars make it clear that to have a dual intention is where a problem comes in. That are we doing the action for Allah and for somebody else or something else? Or is it sincerely for Allah? And this goes for every action in the prayer, both the wajib actions, whatever are the prayers which are a rukun, which are an obligation to do, and also the mustahab. So for example, when I'm doing the qira'at, the recitation, do I choose a long surah so that people can think, wow, mashallah, he's memorized such a long chapter of the Quran? Do I recite that long chapter just so people can be impressed by my memorization? If I do that, then my prayers are null and void because I have a joint intention. My intention was to lead a jamaat prayer, but then I chose a special surah or a special dhikr, even in the kunut, even if it's in the mustahab portion. Sayyid Sistani says that even if you do something for others to show off, to make people think that you know more or have memorized more or for some other reason other than Allah, then that prayer actually becomes completely null and void. There's nothing worth in that prayer for Allah to take from us. So we have to be careful. Those who lead the prayers and those who are following, or if we're leading prayers at home with our spouse and our family, is that we're not doing it to impress other people. Yes? Sure.
So if you know that there are some elderly people in the jamaat,
yes,
and in order to make them comfortable, you recite a small surah.
Okay. Yes.
So you have the intention to make them comfortable, but not to show yourself.
Yes. Yes, so as the brother asked the question, that if, for example, there's elderly people and the prayer leader chooses a short surah to make it easier for them, yep, there's no problem with that. And actually, well, I'll mention that in a bit of more depth in the next part. And actually, it's recommended, as the scholars tell us, that if somebody's leading a jamaat prayer, that person, whether it's a male or a female leading a jamaat prayer, obviously women can lead only for women, but it's recommended that the prayer leader keep in mind everybody within the community. So if he knows or she knows they're elderly, there are people who are, let's say, nursing, women who are nursing their children, they should try and make the prayer such that it doesn't inconvenience or it doesn't make it difficult for other people. Thank you. So again, all of the actions, whether they be wajib, the obligatory, or the recommended, all of them need to be done with that intention of proximity to Allah and not for a dual intention. Ayatul Sistani and all of the Maraji go a step further. And this one I'm going to try to explain a bit slowly because it's got some fine points. So he says that even if a person were to pray his salat in a specific place, for example, in a masjid all the time, but not because they want to go for the thawab, but because they're doing it to show off to the people. Or they pick a certain spot in the masjid. You know, sometimes we see this where a person has their reserved spot in the prayer lines, you know. They'll come and they'll put their hat down and their cell phone and they'll put the turba and the tasbih and they make it known that that's their spot and nobody else should take it. You know, sometimes people will choose a wall to pray at beside. Or they'll choose a certain area in the line that they only have to sit there. And if somebody else sits in their spot, it's hell, you know. It becomes a problem. So if somebody does that because they want to show off, they're having a dual intention. Their intention is not coming to the masjid to get the thawab of praying in the masjid. They're coming to show to the people that, yes, they come to the masjid to pray. Or they pray directly behind the prayer leader. They're doing it not to out of the just, you know, general, you know, praying, but because they want to show off. Then Ayatollah Sistani and all of the Maharajas say that that prayer is actually null and void. Or a person prays at prime time. Now obviously we should be praying at the prime time. But if a person prays in prime time in Jamaat, but not for the sake of Allah, but to show off to the people that he's a religious person or she's a religious person, and for people to, you know, be amazed that that person comes every time on time to pray, and again, only that person knows why they're doing it. So the Maharajas say that even there, if there's a dual intention involved, then even there, that person's prayers are null and void. And the third example that the Maharaja give is if that person makes it a point to pray Jamaat, but not because of the sake of the recommendation from Rasulullah, not because of the reward, but just because of the fact they want to show off, that people say, oh, mashallah, this guy's, you know, he's a namazi. He prays every day in Jamaat, in this line, in this spot of the masjid. And he or she is doing it not for the sake of Allah. And again, you and I shouldn't judge those people. They know themselves why they're praying, where they're praying, how they're praying, and they have to determine that on their own. We shouldn't pass judgment on people in that. That's up to Allah, because only he knows what is in the person's head, what is in our head. But if we fall into this category, and if I fall into that category of praying in a certain way, with certain recitation, and certain other characteristics to show off to the masses, then my prayers are basically null and void. They're complete waste. There is no reward with Allah. And obviously that prayer has to be repeated once a person is able to rectify their intention. One of the questions, as the brother mentioned, is that what if I have a joint intention? For example, he said, with the elderly. But what if I'm at home with my young children, 5, 6, 7 years old, and I'm praying at home, but I'm praying in a different way, maybe a bit louder or a bit slower, and I'm doing it because I want to teach my children how to pray, you know, namaz properly. So Ayatollah Sistani actually addresses this directly in his Risala, which again wasn't in the old version. So if you don't have the new version of the Risala, I would really encourage all of us to purchase it, because he's added a lot of new rulings. He's clarified a lot of rulings he gave in the past with examples, and it'll really make our life much easier to follow the rules of Islam. So he says, if a mother or father are praying Jamaat at home, and they're praying it how they normally wouldn't pray their own namaz, but they're doing it to teach their children the importance of prayers, of how to pray, of how to properly recite. He says, as long as your niyat, your intention is that you're doing it for the sake of Allah, he says, then there is no problem in that. So in this instance, he said, a joint intention is no problem, because you're not praying to show off to your children. You're praying in a new way or a different way to help them learn the fundamentals of how to pray namaz, of how to recite, of how to do all of these actions. So a joint intention of teaching or training your children, and obviously praying to fulfill the rules of Allah, he says, is no problem within our religious teachings. Salu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. I want to share with us a story. This is Sheikh Abbas al-Kummi. I'm sure a lot of us have heard his name. Muhaddith al-Kummi, he's also known. He wrote, compiled Mafatih al-Janan, which is probably the most famous book of du'as that we have today. It's probably in every single person's household. It's translated into multiple languages. The app is there if you want to download it. He's written a lot of books, not just that. He's written over 50 or 60 books. Mafatihul Janan, obviously, is the most famous one, which is, again, available in copies around the world. He has a book called House of Sorrows, which is an English translation, which we had published about 6 or 7 years ago, which details the last 3 months in the life of Fatima Zahra alayhi salam and her eventual shahadat. He has an amazing book about death called Manazil al-Akhirah. So if you want to know what happens after death, the stages, what du'as, what supplications are good to, you know, to prevent the squeezing in the grave and the punishment and the torment, this is the ideal book to read. And another book which is of his in English is called Nafasul Mahmoom, which is a comprehensive look at what happened in Karbala. Again, in English, it's one of the most authoritative, we can say it's one of the most, you know, descriptive books of the tragedy of Karbala. But he is obviously, so he's not an, you know, a normal scholar. He's not your average, everyday, you know, Maulana who comes and goes. He is a scholar of great depth and worth. He's buried in Najaf, so inshallah, when you go to Karbala and you go to Najaf to pay your respects to Amir al-Mu'mineen, make sure you make it to his qabr, his grave, which is just in the courtyard of where the haram of Amir al-Mu'mineen is. But let me share with you a story I read just a few days ago about him. He was in Mashhad, and it was the month of Ramadan. And the story is about intention, so that's why I want to present it tonight. So the story goes that he had gone to Mashhad with a group of his friends who were also great scholars, senior scholars at their own, you know, in their own era. And month of Ramadan, obviously, there's a whole different atmosphere. People are more engaged in worship and prayer and recitation of Quran. So his friends said that why don't we have a Jamaat namaz in one of the courtyards in Mashhad, in the Haram of Imam Radha alayhi salam. Now, if you've been to Mashhad, you know that there is a masjid called Masjid Gohar Shad. And there's a story about behind how it was created, but behind this woman who had it built. I don't want to mention that story, but it's a very beautiful, massive, massive structure of a masjid. So his friend said, let's get together and have a Jamaat namaz here every night. We're all students that are all, you know, in the hawza studying together. So the story mentions that they asked Sheikh Abbas to come in. They said, why don't you lead the Jamaat prayers? So he agreed. And first couple nights, you know, there'd be 3, 4, 5 people, 10 people. It didn't go much more than 10. And then all of a sudden, word got out in Mashhad that Sheikh Abbas al-Kummi is leading prayers in the Haram, in Masjid Gohar Shad. And so the masses began to come, just flocking, because they wanted to pray behind such a great scholar. It's just like when we go for ziyarah today, and we hear that Ayatollah, for example, Zanjani, is leading, you know, prayers in the Haram of Fatima Masuma alayhi salam, and we run to pray behind. So the same thing, that people were flocking in large numbers. And they mentioned that it was sometime in the month of Ramadan, probably the latter half. And Sheikh Abbas al-Kummi finishes his Dhuhr namaz. He turns to his friend who's narrating the story and he says, I have to leave. I can't lead the Asr. You lead Asr, I have to go home. So his friend was a bit perplexed. You know, how can he just leave? He's done Dhuhr. Why does he just pray 4 rakat? And what could be so important, you know? House is on fire, what happened? He didn't know. But Sheikh Abbas al-Kummi leaves the masjid and he goes home. The person who narrates the story says that they didn't see him for an entire year. He didn't come back to pray Jamaat prayers for 1 year. And it's like, wow, what happened in that time? And so they went to Sheikh Abbas al-Kummi. They said, Sheikh, what happened? You were there the month of Ramadan, you led prayers every day, Dhuhr, you led that Asr, you said you can't, and you left. And he tells this story. He says that, as you know, there are only a few people coming to pray every night, maybe 8 or 10 people. He says, as we got further and further into the month, more and more people were coming to pray Jamaat behind me. He says that I was in the 4th rakat of my Dhuhr namaz, and I heard somebody from far away saying, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Inna Allah ma'a sabirin, meaning, keep going in ruku, I want to join the Jamaat. And this person was far back, maybe 30, 40, 50 lines behind him. So there's hundreds of people, thousands of people praying behind him. Sheikh Abbas al-Kummi himself says, when I heard that man Say, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, to continue in the ruku. He says, I thought to myself, MashaAllah, I'm so famous that so many people want to pray behind me. And he says, that thought changed my intention. I'm not praying for Allah. Now I'm praying because there's thousands of people behind me in this jamaat. And he says, I couldn't pray my asr. I had no way that I could now purify my intention and lead asr with a clear conscience. So he said, I sat at home for a year to work on my own nafs, that I could now be worthy of coming and leading a jamaat prayer. Imagine a man who's written 50 books, maybe over 100, 150 volumes, studies his whole life. And that one thought of somebody wanting to join the jamaat, but he felt that, wow, so many people are praying behind me. His niyyah changed for a split second. And it took him a year to work on his soul, to change that niyyah within himself. So it shows us how delicate our intention is, how careful we have to be with every single thing that we do in our life. God forbid we don't go into a dual intention even for a second of our lives. Because if we do, as Sheikh Abbas al-Kumi shows, it took him a year to change his outlook. Imagine how long it might take us, it might take me maybe 10 years to be able to clean myself of that one impure thought, that one second that changed his entire life. Salu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. I want to end with one last hadith. It's a two-part hadith, which is about the intention, but also about where we end up in this world, after this world, either heaven or, God forbid, the fire of hell. And inshallah, we pray that none of us even have to see what the fire of hell is all about. One of the things that we see in the Quran is that Allah has mentioned that there are people who will remain in hellfire forever. Allah says many times, خَالِدِينَ فِيهَا أَبَدًا, that they will stay in hell forever. And also Allah tells us that some people will get to Jannah, to paradise, and they will also stay in Jannah forever. And one of the questions that has come up sometimes in the minds of the people is that, how is that fair? How can I lead a life of 50, 60, 70, 80 years, 100 years, and my 100 years on earth, that existence, allows me to live in Jannah forever, if I was a good person in this life? How is that a fair trade or recompense? I live 100 years, and Allah says, now you have paradise forever. And conversely, if a person was a bad person, they did all of the things which religion prohibited, and yet they are condemned to hell forever. How is that fair? How can Allah throw somebody into hell forever? Not for a week or two, but forever. For only 30 years or 40 years of transgression. At one level, it doesn't seem fair. I mean, he only did 40 years of sin. Punish him for 40 years in the fire and then let him go to heaven. And similarly, the person who did good for 40, 50, 60 years, they only did good for 60 years. They should only have Jannah for 60 years and maybe then be in some, you know, suspended state of animation between heaven and hell for the rest of eternity. But we have a tradition which shows us how the intention is the outcome that we receive in the world to come. And what we do in this world is justified by Allah to either give us heaven forever or, God forbid, to put us into hell until he sees fit. And this is what the tradition says. Again, it's a two-part tradition. The tradition says, indeed, the inhabitants of the hellfire shall remain in the hellfire forever, as their intention, as their niyat, while in this world, was that if only we could live forever in this world, we would continue to disobey Allah forever. So these people, they deserve the fire of hell forever because their wish was that, I wish I lived on earth forever. I would always go against the rules of Allah. I would always steal. I would always kill. I would always do this. I would always do that. So their entire niyyah, their intention in life was not that they wanted to change and become a better person. They knew they were doing wrong, and they say they wish they could live forever and continue to do those wrong actions. And so if Allah puts them into the fire of hell forever, He's justified, because these people themselves said that if we could live forever, we would live a life of inequity forever. So it's not that Allah is being unfair. They get what they want. They get what they are asking for from Allah. But on the other side of the equation, heaven forever. The same thing. Indeed, the inhabitants of paradise shall remain in paradise forever, as their intention while in this world was that if only we could live forever in this world, they would continue to obey Allah forever. Therefore, it is based on the intention, as the Imam says, therefore it is based on the intention, on their niyat, that these groups will continue to reside in their respective places. So it's not injustice by Allah. Allah is not being unfair to people. Allah is showing us that we ourselves are making our own world to come. And if we have that thought, I wish I could live forever and I could steal and swindle people and rip people off and do this and do that, then we deserve what we get forever. But if we say, you know what, I wish I could live forever so I could serve Allah, so I could help humanity, so I could feed the poor, so I could take care of the homeless, so I could work in a soup kitchen, so I could help my community prosper and grow and move ahead. If I have that intention, then Allah has every right to keep us in paradise forever, because our thought is that as long as I live, I'm going to be a good person, and if I could live forever, I would continue to be good. It's just like those Sahaba on the day of Ashura, where they would tell Imam Hussein alayhi salam that if they were to kill me and cut my body up and burn it and throw the ashes into the wind, and they were to do that over and over and over again, the Sahaba of Imam Hussein says, I would not stop giving my support to you, Ya Aba Abdullah. This is what we have to reach to, brothers and sisters, to have such a conviction in our religion, in our teachings, that if we had the ability to live forever, if we were given that opportunity, that we wouldn't waver, that we would continue to be followers of Islam and to be the servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Let me close in just 1 or 2 minutes and mention one of the tragedies of Lady Zahra alayhi salam, as we're going through these ayam of Fatimiya, these days and nights of the tragedy of Lady Zahra alayhi salam. Sheikh Abbas Akummi, in his book, Baytul Ahzan, The House of Sorrows, he mentions a very tragic narration that I want to share with you tonight. And this is about how Imam Hassan and Hussein alayhi salam found out about the death of their mother, Bibi Fatima alayhi salam. We're told that Asma bint Umais was in the house with Lady Zahra alayhi salam. Imam Ali was not there. He was in the masjid taking care of business. Imam Hassan and Hussein had also left the house. It was just Asma and Bibi Fatima alayhi salam. We're told that Asma had put Bibi Fatima facing towards the Qibla. She told Asma, she says that, I'm going to be reciting a dhikr, you leave the room. However, when you don't hear me reciting a dhikr anymore, know that I have left this world. Sheikh Abbas Akummi mentions that after some short time, that Asma doesn't hear Lady Zahra reciting anything anymore. She realizes now that this is the time that Lady Zahra has left this world. She goes into the room and she sees Lady Fatima lying on the bed. She realizes that she is no longer. Asma bint Umais leaves the house. She goes into the streets of Medina. The first people that she sees are young Hassan and Hussein. Now keep in mind, these young boys are only maybe 8 or 9 years old. They see Asma bint Umais. They ask her, how is our mother? How is our mother Fatima? She doesn't say a word, and right away Imam Hassan and Hussein realize that something is wrong. Sheikh Abbas Akummi mentions that they run into the house. Imam Hussein first makes his way to the body of his mother. He begins to shake Bibi Fatima. He begins to call out to her and cry to his mother. She doesn't reply. Imam Hussein turns to his brother, Imam Hassan. He looks at Imam Hassan, and Imam Hassan realizes that Bibi Fatima is no more. Sheikh Abbas Akummi mentions that Imam Hassan throws himself over the body of Bibi Fatima. Imam Hussein begins to kiss her feet. They begin to cry and lament over the death of their mother Fatima. They make their way to the masjid to tell Amir al-Mu'mineen, to tell their father, Imam Ali, what has happened. Imam Ali falls down. He regains his consciousness and he makes his way to his house to bid that last farewell to the body of his beloved wife, Lady Zahra.
وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيُّ مُنْقَلِبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ إِنَّ لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. Ya Allah, we ask you bihaqq Fatima and her father and her husband and her two children that you accept this act of worship from us tonight. Ya Allah, we ask you to allow us to be able to understand your religion, to understand the teachings that you gave to Muhammad and Ali Muhammad, and that we can learn to follow and implement them in our lives on a day-to-day basis. Ya Allah, we ask you to hasten in the advent and the zuhur of our 12th Imam, Imam Al-Hujjah, and that we can be considered to be worthy as being his followers and adherents and supporters when he returns to establish a kingdom of freedom, of justice and equality, and that he work with Prophet Isa, Prophet Jesus alayhi salam, to establish a kingdom of God upon the earth. Rabbana taqabbal minna innaka anta as-sami'ul alim. Let us recite one surah Fatiha before that. Salawat for the thawab of all of the marhameen, from our family, for our parents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, for all of those who have left us, for the ulama who have left this world, for the shuhada who have given their blood for the sake of Islam. Surah Mubarakatul Fatiha. Before that, one loud salawat upon Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.